Cable versus Nichols. I see we have experienced counsel already set up. You both received our written instructions. Either of you have any questions? For members of our audience, if any of you has a cell phone or similar device, would you please turn it off so the attorneys are not interrupted? On that basis, we're ready for argument in People v. Nichols.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. May I please the court? My name is Mark Walta, registration number 30990. I'm appearing on behalf of Timothy Nichols, the appellant in this matter. I'm going to focus my arguments pretty much exclusively on issue number two, which is the issue with respect to the count of conspiracy and associated evidence. Obviously, I'm not intending that as any sort of implied comment on the strength of the other issues, and I'm certainly not waiving the right to respond to any arguments that the state may make with respect to those issues, but it's a conceptually difficult issue, and I want to spend some time on it. The prosecution argued in this case that it was a case about money, meth, and a miserable marriage. Its theory was that these forces combined to cause Tim Nichols and his wife to conspire to burn down their house with their children inside to recover insurance proceeds that would permit them to start their lives anew. As the prosecution, I think, forthrightly conceded both to the court and to the jurors, the biggest obstacle that it faced in this case was convincing a jury that this man could kill his own children. The prosecution, in our view, sought to overcome this hurdle by effectively amending the indictment to allege a conspiracy to commit murder. The conspiracy count, whether proven to the jury's satisfaction or not, allowed the prosecution to bring in virtual mountains of evidence with respect to Deb Nichols and her actions both before and after the fire. The prosecution insisted that this case was not about Deb Nichols, but any fair reading of the record reveals that this case revolved around her and her actions both before and after the fire. 16-5-101 makes clear that the prosecution must, in effect, pick its poison when it commences a prosecution. It can't use multiple charging methods simultaneously.
Mr. Walter, I don't see that in the statute. Where in 501 does it say that you can't use multiple charging methods simultaneously?
Well, what the statute says is that the prosecution may initiate the criminal action by one of the following methods and then uses the disjunctive or in the course of the statute, which I think reinforces the command that when the prosecution initiates a criminal action, it must do it by one of those methods. I think that in tandem with such provisions as CRIMP 7 C and H strongly suggest that if a prosecution is initiated by grand jury indictment, the prosecution has to proceed by grand jury indictment. Now, there are exceptions to that. You know, for instance, the prosecutor could impanel a grand jury, the grand jury could return true bills, the prosecutor could elect not to execute the indictment and proceed by information or complaint instead.
And couldn't it then seek to join separately charged all the time? You have a joinder issue, try to join separately charged crimes.
Well, but that's not what occurred in this case. What occurred in this case is you had the grand jury return true bills. The prosecution executed the indictment and then later moved to amend the indictment by information under the same case. It's not a situation where the prosecution brings separate charges under a separate case number and then moves to join under compulsory joinder provisions the two cases together.
But it did that without objection, is that right?
It did. Counsel did not object. That's true. But in our view, that's immaterial because it's a jurisdictional issue. Whether or not defense counsel failed to object to it is immaterial because, of course, you can't confer subject matter jurisdiction by consent. And there is no waiver of a jurisdictional defect.
But I guess that's what I'm saying. I don't mean to belabor the point, but I'm stuck with the fact that had the And you say it's all the same number, and I accept that. Mm-hmm. But had they, in a different number, charged a conspiracy count through information and then moved to join them, there'd be no jurisdictional problem with that, would there?
Probably not.
So it seems like a matter of form over substance. That's what I'm struggling
with. Well, except that the CRIMPI 6.8 has very specific prohibitions built into it. And what the rule says, in effect, is you can apply to the court and seek leave of the court to amend an indictment as to form. What you are not permitted to do is to apply to the court and to seek leave of the court to amend the indictment as to substance. And I think that the well-settled intent underlying the rule is that the prosecution can't effectively evade the will of the grand jury by going back in and amending the indictment as to substance. What it must do under those circumstances is resubmit the matter to the grand jury and seek a superseding indictment, which occurs all the time. Granted, proceeding by indictment in Colorado is, I think, relatively speaking, not as common as, for instance, in the federal courts. But, you know, in my limited experience, and they're usually COCA cases, where the prosecution is elected to proceed by indictment, when they seek to amend the indictment as to the substance, they resubmit the cause to the grand jury and seek a superseding indictment. I don't know that I've ever run across a situation where the prosecution has filed under the same case number and information which purports to amend the indictment. I still have not found a case in Colorado that endorses that charging methodology, or at least implicitly it endorses it. And so the fundamental problem in this case is that you have a conspiracy count, which is, I don't think there's going to be any argument really. It's a substantive count. It's separate and distinct from the object offense, and is separately punishable. It was clearly an amendment as to the substance. If that's true, if the court accepts all of that, then it must conclude that the indictment was improperly amended to include the conspiracy count.
And that's the springboard for your evidentiary objection.
It is. And the nature of the evidentiary objection, of course, is the express purpose for admitting this, virtually all of this evidence, was to buttress and support the conspiracy count. And I think it follows from that, if in fact the conspiracy count was not properly before the jury, this evidence was necessarily irrelevant. And I don't think that there's much argument either that it was highly prejudicial evidence.
Didn't the trial court make alternative findings that the evidence came in under 404B and is res gestae?
Well, I think the res gestae theory was inextricably linked to the conspiracy count, though. It's hard for me to see precisely what the relevance is. The res gestae, of course, is still subject to 403 limitations. But it was clear that, and the prosecution's primary purpose in admitting this evidence was to prove up the conspiracy count. Now, whether some of this evidence might be admissible for some of the limited purposes set forth under 404B is possible. However, for instance, as to issues of motive and whatnot, Deborah Nichols' actions shed very little light on Mr. Nichols' motives absent the conspiracy charge. The only reason most of this evidence was admissible within the context of the conspiracy count was the sort of concurrence of mental states and the commonality of action that's at the core of a conspiracy charge. Beyond that, Deborah Nichols' actions, statements, behaviors bear very little on issues of motive with respect to Mr. Nichols, absent the allegation of a conspiracy between them to kill their children for insurance purposes.
Even if there were no conspiracy, Mr. Walter, if she knew that was what he was planning to do and she was not surprised that it in fact took place, wouldn't that be relevant information that would be properly admissible for the jury to hear?
I don't see how it would, absent some sort of a conspiracy, some sort of count that requires some concurrence or commonality.
They wouldn't necessarily have had to conspire, but if she might have known that he was going to do it, even absent a conspiracy.
Well, the problem with this evidence, and I suppose this is always the problem that confronts the court whenever you're judging the harmlessness of evidence, is that you have to engage in sort of a theoretical and largely speculative determination of, well, okay, let's assume that the conspiracy count was improperly before the jury, and let's assume that this evidence was improperly admitted to prove up the conspiracy count. Are there potential other bases on which you could admit at least some of the evidence? Sure, it's possible, but I would submit to the court that engaging the harmlessness vel non of this evidence, maybe the analysis should be, what would this prosecution look like without the master narrative of the conspiracy? And there's no doubt that was the master narrative in this case. The master narrative was that Tim Nichols and Deb Nichols conspired to burn down their house with the children inside in order to recover insurance proceeds. That was the master narrative. If the conspiracy count is gone, if the evidence based on that conspiracy is gone, what would the trial have looked like?
Mr. Walter, along those lines, I'm having a little trouble with your premise that the conspiracy charge was the necessary predicate for the admission of this evidence. The trial court wrote, a very thorough four-page single-space order allowing the evidence in response to the people's motion, notice of 404B. And I don't see reference to the conspiracy. I see that it's the prosecution's theory of the case that these two were so desperate financially and addled with drug usage that they would be driven to take such extreme and incomprehensible actions, at least as alleged by the prosecution. I don't see a lot of reliance, or quite frankly any reliance, on the fact that conspiracy was formally charged.
That was the prosecution's express purpose for admitting the evidence.
On the trial court's order admitting it, though, I see references to their theory of the case that the defendant and his wife, an uncharged co-conspirator, became heavily addicted. But it's the references are to their theory of the case, and that theory of the case would be the same, would it not, whether or not a formal conspiracy charge was in there. As Judge Terry suggested, I think, in explaining a murder charge or murder charges, it's relevant. What could have driven this person and allegedly his wife to take such incomprehensible actions?
Well, in the absence of a conspiracy charge, I think the question arises, to what extent can the prosecution argue a de facto conspiracy when in fact they've not charged one under the law?
Could they be complicitors even in the absence of a conspiracy charge?
They could have if the prosecution had pursued that theory.
But there's no pleading requirement. There would not be a comparable pleading requirement as you're arguing with conspiracy, would there?
Well, with respect to complicity, I think the law is fairly clear that they wouldn't have had to have charged that.
Yeah.
This is true. But they didn't pursue accomplice liability for, I think, some very good reasons, because their position was that Mr. Nichols was the principal in this. Now, whether or not they pursued an accomplice liability theory in Deb Nichols' trial, I don't know.
Okay.
I could certainly see it being more appropriate under those circumstances, but I could also see the prosecution saying, we're not going to pursue it here for fear of confusing the jury about where we're going. I see that I have a minute left. I don't want to put your honors off. I would like to reserve a little time in the rebuttal, if that's okay. Thank you.
May it please the court and counsel, my name is Paul Kaler. I'm a first assistant attorney general in the appellate division at the AG's office. My registration number is 19210. On this issue, We think that this is, the issue is moot for a couple of reasons. One, he was acquitted, or not acquitted, but the jury could not arrive at a verdict concerning the conspiracy charge, so it doesn't really matter. And secondly, as the court has already been addressing, the evidence would have otherwise been admissible under CRE 404B because it went to his motive, and it would also have been admissible under complicitor liability because it was evidence that showed that he had a complicitor who was assisting him and encouraging him in the commission of this crime, which is what complicitor liability is all about. Therefore, even if for some reason the charging instrument was not done correctly, this evidence still would have been come in no matter how the case was particularly charged. As far as the actual charging the method used at this additional charge, of course, I'd like to remind the court that direct evidence of the conspiracy supporting the conspiracy count came through the defendant's own words after he was indicted on the original charges, sent to jail, and then spoke to the jailhouse informant who, as all of them are inherently trustworthy, but the informant knew things that the investigation had uncovered that had not been revealed publicly, and also things which the investigation had not learned about beforehand but was able to verify later. That's when the conspiracy count was added. We don't think this is an amendment to the grand jury indictment at all. And the amendment cases all talk about changing the actual language that the grand jury wrote down. Here, the grand jury's language in the original counts were not changed at all. And even under Rule 6.8, there can be minor changes to grand jury language to correct errors or minor variations in the proof. But here, there wasn't even that. We wouldn't even have minor changes to the grand jury's language. Here we have an additional count made after this new evidence was brought in. And I looked long and hard, too, and I couldn't find anything prohibiting or endorsing this method.
Mr. Taylor, I'm not familiar with this particular practice, so maybe you can help me out here. If there's a normal way that this is usually done, when you have a grand jury indictment and then you have additional information that was not available to the prosecution previously, how is this normally handled?
Oftentimes it's done by superseding indictment, which can be done.
Which means you send it back to another grand jury, or?
Could be sent to, the same grand jury is still in existence, be sent back to them, otherwise to
a new grand jury.
Could have been done under, by filing the conspiracy count under a separate number, separate case numbers information, and then moving to consolidate the cases. And here too, this is just another alternate means of doing that.
Do you agree as a matter of form, it's at least unusual to add a charge in the same case number when there's an indictment?
Sure. I've asked a bunch of trial prosecutors in my office and other places how they deal with this situation, and they usually use superseding, but they didn't know of any prohibition against doing it this particular way. And I think probably the practical means is, since the grand jury, my understanding is the grand jury proceedings in this thing were very extensive. The grand jury was used as an investigative tool to get people on the record, the drug dealers, and get them on the record to make them tell the truth. And to do a superseding indictment in this particular case would have involved a huge amount of additional resources having to set forth the whole case over the period of weeks again. And I think this was just a permissible means of meeting that. And I think 16.5.101, the charging instrument statute, I think the key language in there, which is what we highlighted in our brief, it says, provides that a criminal action, quote, for the violation of any statute. And I think that's key, because when it talks about the violation of a statute, that means each violation of a statute. If the charging statute had talked about, had used language something along the lines of a criminal prosecution concerning a criminal transaction may be done by any of these means, I think that would be some sort of words of limitation. Here there's no words of limitation, and therefore I think it's permissible to use any of these means. I guess, you know, theoretically, and I think it would be odd to see it, a case could be charged under all the various means under that, but I think that would be kind of weird. But what was done here, I think it was not prohibited. It's permissible under the statute, and the defendant was not harmed by that. If you look at the purpose of charging instruments, is to give the defendant notice so that he can defend himself against the charges, and also to prevent double jeopardy problems. Here, neither of those problems is affected at all. And this new added count was subject to a probable cause hearing, which was done in the proper way, and which the trial court found made a probable cause determination, so that the evidence supporting this additional count was clearly set out to the defendant. Let's see.
And just a historical note, what was this, an El Paso County grand jury, or say what it was?
El Paso County grand jury.
Especially convened for this case? Or
for this particular case is my understanding, Your Honor, because they were, I'm not sure, this is mostly based on talking to the trial prosecutors, but it was done, it uses an investigatory tool, as opposed to having, like my office, when we use grand juries for our financial fraud type cases, we conduct our investigations and then present our case to the grand jury, wrapped up with a bow, as it were. But this was actually investigative type grand jury. If the court would like, I could talk about the other issues. I'm pretty comfortable about resting on the brief concerning them.
Before we get off this issue, Mr. Kaler, what about the concept that this is a jurisdictional issue, a jurisdictional defect, if in fact it is a defect at all?
I think the substantive defects all have to do with giving the defendant notice of the charges themselves. Like if you look at some of the defendant's cases, Sawyer, that was a jurisdictional defect because he was not charged with a particular crime, not charged with a crime, and not even a crime that existed in law at that time. And as Zupancic case, the details given there were not sufficient to state an offense within the jurisdiction of the court. Here, the form of the substance of the conspiracy count all set forth the proper things the defendant needs in order to defend himself against a charge and to protect himself against double jeopardy. And therefore, our argument is that provides the trial court with jurisdiction to address the claim.
But wouldn't your first point also go to that? I mean, you argued it was moot. Any alleged jurisdictional defect is moot because we're not talking about whether he can be properly convicted on the conspiracy count. This is just a predicate for his evidentiary argument, isn't it?
Correct, Your Honor. Yeah, and so our belief is that this evidence would have come in either under 404B for proper purposes or come in as res gestae evidence or as a complicitor evidence. And
help me understand how those concepts pick up, I'm going to say this delicately, but the wife's very cold behavior concerning her children's death after the fire. I mean, what does that have to do with 404B, for example?
It shows their joint motive. It goes to their joint motive that they did not care about the children. They only cared about the bunny.
It shows that she didn't. What does it say about his attitude toward the children?
Well, it shows that she had a strong motive, and that if she was assisting and encouraging him in order to commit this crime, then that would support his motive as well.
As a complicitor. Okay, but just on straight up 404B.
Not directly. I guess it would be some circumstantial evidence supporting his motive, that she had a very strong motive and that he was a weak person and that he was operating at her direction. That would be, if she had a very strong motive and he was weak as he appeared to be in this particular case, that would provide evidence that his motive was to assist in her motive.
Thank you.
Any other questions I could try and help the court with? Thank you very much.
I would simply say that opposing counsel's response to your question, Judge Webb, illustrates my point, which is this evidence only had relevance even in the context of 404B, in the context of some sort of a conspiracy type theory, joint motive, joint mental state, commonality of purpose and action. That was the only basis for admitting this evidence, because of course Deborah Nichols' actions, her own actions, her own statements, her own behaviors only applied to her. They said very little about Tim Nichols' state of mind, his motivation, any of that. And that's the problem with entering, with admitting this evidence, irrespective of whether or not the jury hung on the conspiracy count. And we'd ask you to reverse the conviction in this case because it infected these entire proceedings. Thank you.
We appreciate the arguments of both counsel. The case stands submitted. We will issue a written opinion in due course. Since this exhausts our docket, counsel are excused, and the bailiff may announce a recess.
All right.